Owen, first of all, you're a GAA historian and you're an author, and tell us something about yourself and your background.
Well, Kerry is a very important part of it. My parents are West Clare, and I would have grown up with that sort of sense, even though I grew up in County Kildare, with that, the Atlantic was blowing somewhere through my childhood all the time, be it summers down in the west of Ireland, trips to the Gaeltacht, to the Aran Islands, things like that. But when after my father died, I won a scholarship, one of the old Gaelin scholarships, people will remember, listeners will remember, and you went to a national school in the west of Ireland, somewhere in the Gaeltacht region. And I went out to Ceantra, stayed with a wonderful family, the O'Grifa family in Cahirbuilleac, and very close to where Paddy O'Shea's mum had his had the pub, and was part of that community for about 3 months in 1972. Very important year. It was a lost All-Ireland for Kerry in many ways. Tony McTague kicking over those frees. And I was fascinated because I really hadn't come into contact with the way that Gaelic football sweeps over every aspect of life. It's central to culture, it's central to people's, even their status in society. A five All-Ireland medal man was a bit better than a three All-Ireland medal man. All of these things made a deep impression on me, and it's a great impression because it did change my life and it did influence massively my career. I wanted to be a sports writer, and everything that I've done since then.
Tell us something about what you have produced. You have written numerous books.
I've done a lot of books. I do a book, virtually a sports book a year. There'll be the Illustrated History of the GAA is the one that's most in that would be in print, that people might be familiar with quite regularly. There is will be a History of Gaelic Football coming at the end of this year with Gillan McMillan. I still write about sport, even though I'm a travel writer by profession, and I spend my life travelling incessantly. I still have the growl for sport, and I will look in to the most odd events. I'll be looking in at basketball matches and the Highland Games and a soccer match wherever I can go, you know, a Moroccan League match between Agadir and somebody like. But all the time, you keep coming back to the GAA because there is no sporting organisation you come across anywhere in the world that is so heavily embedded in the community as the GAA is. You don't join the GAA. You're just told, you're a member when you're told to turn up with your boots because they're short somebody. It's automatically assumed that if you're in the community, you're in the GAA. It's a terrific organisation. There are no Russian billionaires. That great stadium in Croke Park is owned by every single person who is a member, or isn't even the ones who aren't a member. The ones who just go along to look, or anybody who expresses a passing interest in the GAA. And that is, I think, as close to true community, patriotism, whatever else that you're going to come across in any organisation anywhere in the world. I've travelled the world and I'm very, very still don't think I've come across anything like it.
And of course, this is the 125th anniversary of the Gaelic Athletic Association, and indeed Croke Park are pulling out all the stops to celebrate it. I met you in Croke Park lately, who gave a wonderful talk on the history of the GAA. And where does Kerry come in all of it? Kerry would have appeared in Croke Park, for instance, more than any other county in Ireland. And they have been, the GAA is embedded in its history, and it has got over political divides, and it has brought people together. And it's, as you said, a huge part and parcel of life in the county. What do we know about the history of the GAA in Kerry, Owen?
Well, it's amazing how many aspects of the GAA, when you talk about them, when you begin to talk about them, and the GAA, you know, you can discuss GAA history forever, and we enjoy doing it, we all enjoy doing it, but how many of the points come back to Kerry? It would be Kerry spent a long while, they didn't win their first All-Ireland until 1903, but even in that period their contribution was phenomenal, even though it would not have as many clubs as some of the other Munster counties in the 1890s. It was Kerry really that got the notion that a county team be drawn from all the clubs in the county, not from one club. In the very early days, Limerick Commercials would have been the first football champions, and Thurles the first hurling champions. And for about 6 or 7 years afterwards, it was pretty much standard that, like the All-Ireland Club Championship today, the club that wins the county championship represents the county. What happened was that some of the hurling clubs in Kerry disbanded so that Kilmoyle could pick the best of their players. And in 1893, Kerry played in an All-Ireland hurling final. Now, they weren't successful, but the notion of a county team was born out of that, because all the other counties started looking at ways round how do you pick the best players from other clubs. Within a couple of years, we had a situation where all the county teams were picked by the club and were selected from the best in the county. That's a Kerry invention. Kerry would have been pretty much behind the reorganisation of the GAA in Munster around 1900. What happened was the GAA went into a serious decline in the 1890s, got revived in 1900. Various reasons for this. A lot of people attribute it to the introduction of provincial councils. Provincial councils, really, until modern times, is where the power in the GAA lies. It doesn't lie in Croke Park. It's really the provincial councils that had the finances could take control of initiatives. And some of the personalities, Thomas F. Fitzgerald, the very first historian of the GAA, would be among those. Austin Stack would be another. But what Kerry did in 1903 changed everything, because they introduced the notion of collective training. It wasn't the collective training that people remember later on, but they gathered the players in Tralee and in Killarney. There was one player from Castle Island who cycled down to Killarney for twice a week training. They played, the Tralee boys played the Killarney boys. By the time the All-Ireland final came around, they had a pretty strong cohesive unit. And they won the All-Ireland, which took three attempts to play. There was a disputed goal at the end of the first one. The second one was drawn, and the third one drew a very big crowd by the standards, 18,000, into the Cork Athletic Grounds. That gave the GAA money. It gave it a little bit of status. People started taking it seriously. And Kerry went on over the following decade to dominate Gaelic football. When the teams were reduced from 17-a-side to 15-a-side, and they played pretty crucial match. Paddy Foley, some listeners will remember, the great Kerry man, GA correspondent, he would have said that the second match between Kerry and Louth for the 1930 Croke Memorial Tournament was the greatest football game ever played. Now, obviously, this is an argument that'll go on forever. People will say the 77 semi-final, and, you know, the 91 matches, Dublin and Meath, 94 Derry Donegal, all those matches. But 1913 benefited the GAA in another way, and it's probably Kerry's biggest contribution to the GAA. It enabled them to buy Croke Park. Croke Park was sort of held in trust by its secretary for a couple of years, but the money generated by that Kerry Louth series in 1913 enabled the GAA to buy Croke Park. That meant that an organisation which really hadn't a presence in the capital city, it was doing very well in Munster. All-Ireland finals were doing well when they were played in Tipperary or Cork or places like that. It now had a home of its own in Dublin. It managed to build up, first of all, put in a pavilion, things like that, and they eventually, in the 1920s, put in the old Hogan stand, the long stand and the short stand. They were, some of the people will remember, memories will go back that far. 1938, the old Cusack stand came in. That was pretty much cutting edge for the time. 1959, the new Hogan stand came in. But it's interesting that all of this was paid for. All of this had to be paid for. And the way it was paid for was the crowds generated by the series of rivalries that Kerry set up with other football counties. The GAA is very hurling focused. Hurling is the ancient game. Hurling is the game of Cú Chulainn. But when it came to actually paying the bill, which is really important, it was football that did that, and it was the Kerry teams of the years that did that.
And Owen, who were the men that were responsible for actually saying, we must buy this piece of land here in Dublin? Because there's one man in Killarney, he's known as Small Joe O'Leary. And it's reputed here that he was one of the men that was instrumental in buying Croke Park. What do we know of the men who actually bought it and made the big decision?
Well, the big decision was an interesting one, because everybody, Frank Dineen, who was a Limerick man, was the secretary who came up with the money in 1910. Now, the Butterley, Maurice Butterley's grounds is what Croke Park was at the time. And it was pretty rough. It was a bit out of town. Jones's Road was regarded as pretty much out of Dublin at the time. And it, Bohemian Soccer Club had used it, lots of other, they used it for trotting, you know, the pony with the little carriage behind it, all of those sort of things. But in 1910, it came available for sale. It could have turned into housing. That's what happened to Clonturk Park, which is where J.P. O'Sullivan's Lone Rangers played in the 1891 All-Ireland football final. It happened an awful lot of the Elm Park, which would have been used in very early GA matches in Dublin, is now the site of St. Vincent's Hospital. So all of these greenfield sites were being lost. But Dineen was the man who... Sullivan's Lone Rangers played in the 1891 All-Ireland football final. It happened an awful lot of the Elm Park, which would have been used in very early GA matches in Dublin, is now the site of St. Vincent's Hospital. So all of these greenfield sites were being lost. But Dineen was the man who said, we have to buy it. He didn't really have the money. He paid the money over. He got it back from the GA 2 years later. The debate over whether they buy Croke Park, pretty well supported. Kerry delegates very much in favour. One Cork delegate, and I am on Kerry Radio so I can say this, said that this was a bad thing to do because it would turn the GA into a professional organisation. And it seems that everybody except Cork thought that buying Croke Park was a good idea. But they
even back then Cork were at it.
there was always an element of troublemakers down in Cork. And, you know, almost all the fractiousness that you would come across in the early GA would involve at least one Cork man somewhere along the way. Yeah, you're right.
So after Croke Park was bought, and bring us up along in part with the big events in the GA, and where were Kerry involved in it?
Well, the development of Gaelic football from pretty much a kick and rush game, and people would have seen, you know, J.P. O'Sullivan would have played a different sort of game than it would be unrecognisable even 20 years later. But you've got to remember also that in the 40s, when Paddy Meegan, a great sports writer, it was Carberry, known as Carberry in its columns in the Examiner, some of the listeners will remember Carberry's annual, the GA annual, came out every year. He would have gone back to some of the very early Kerry footballers, and he was very interested in the crossover from Cad, the village game that was played in Kerry, to Gaelic football. What he wrote was basically, it was a pretty straight crossover from the old Cad to the game that was played in the 1890s. What seems to have happened, though, and it's something I've come across, I've explored a little bit myself, is that there was a period when, in the 1870s, when several Kerry clubs, and they would have included clubs from Killarney, from Fieries, from Killorglin itself, all affiliated to the rugby union, or didn't affiliate to the rugby union, but played something a bit like rugby, except that they weren't scoring points and tries, they were scoring cools. And you have a lot of match reports in the 1870s. And remember, this is 10 years before Maurice Davin drew up the first rules for football, of a football that was played in Kerry. So you could actually see that Kerry's football pedigree predates the GAA, and it's not rugby, and it's not soccer, and it's not anything that was imported from anywhere else. And in fact, it could have influenced not just Gaelic football as it was played in those 1890s and 1900s, but also there was a very strong Kerry connection in the Irish guys who went to mine in the goldfields of Victoria around Melbourne, and the Australian rules football, it was organised and codified about 20 years before Gaelic football, but it had the point posts and it had those goal posts which the early GA had, and it had that catch and kick element to it, the high fielding element. I wonder, is that an element that is a particularly Kerry brand that has been left in both Australian rules and on the early GAA? And when in 1913, as I mentioned, they reduced the number of players aside from 17 down to 15, there's no doubt that the key artist, the man who wrote the book, the very first book on how to play Gaelic football, but who also decided how the new field positions should be played by the different, what the strengths and weaknesses of the various field positions should be, was Dick Fitzgerald. Obviously, a lot of his reputation was gained. An early death is always good for giving you a great reputation, as any Jim Morrison fan or anyone would know, James Dean. But he died on the eve of the 1930 All-Ireland Football Final. The stadium in Killarney obviously is named after him. But we've had a biography of Dick Fitzgerald in recent years, and I think it's a process that's beginning to evaluate the contribution of this one man. Remember, he was 17 in 1903 when Kerry won that first All-Ireland. It was a bit of kick and rush stuff going on. But by 1930, 1940, he was talking about the football of the old days. Even in 1914, the football of the old days was being talked about, and how it was unscientific, it was a bit kick and rush, it was involved wrestling, it involved a lot of shoulder charging. And he was looking to create a more scientific game. And he keeps using the phrase, and he keeps talking about the characteristics. And he says that Gaelic football, more than rugby and more than soccer, involves thought, it involves the brain over the brawn, because there's so many individual personal skills involved. On a team, on a field with 34 different footballers, too difficult for these skills to be brought out. When the teams were reduced to 15 a side, it gave the space and the room. And if you look at particularly Eamon Fitzgerald, the famous Kerry trainer, and he had this very rigorous philosophy. His book in 1958 says, man stays in his position, you don't move. He gave out when I think it was Gary McMahon scored the goal against Roscommon at the 1962 All-Ireland Football Final, everybody in Kerry celebrated except Eamon, because he said, that wasn't your corner. It was the other corner forward should have scored that goal. He was a man, he believed you stayed in your zone and kicked out of that zone, and you stayed within that zone. But all what he and Fitzgerald would have had in common, and it's something that the modern sports coaches all talk about, is the creation of space. What Dick Fitzgerald was talking about is moving light forwards, you know, making room, kicking the ball into ahead of the forward so that the forward gathers it facing the right direction with the right speed. Eamon Fitzgerald, rigorous, keep in your zone. You have this little square, you can't stay out of it. If you're a cornerback, you have a cornerback zone. If you're a midfielder, you have that. He wouldn't even cross over.
That's the Dr. Eamon O'Sullivan.
Dr. Eamon O'Sullivan, yeah. Wouldn't even cross over the midfielders. Yeah. If you're a number 8, you stay on one side. If you're number 9, the other. So it's all about the creation of space. And it's so interesting that the development of Gaelic football as we know it has been one Kerry innovator after another. And then we had this, you know, people almost parodying and taking, looking at what Dr. Eamon O'Sullivan was at and saying, how do we mess with that? And of course, people came and tried to mess with it in Dublin in 1955.
Down in the 60s.
Dublin in 1955 didn't succeed. Yeah. Down in the 60s did. There was a great Tiggy Lang quote about, when Kerry won back the All-Ireland in 1969, that's beaten the fellas with the blackboard tactics. Yeah. But when somebody does come and mess with the game as Kerry played with it and beat them at the game, Kerry doesn't go back and sulk. Kerry comes back the following year with something, you know, takes all the tactics. I think, the Paddy O'Shea and Mick O'Dwyer, or sorry, Michael Ned Sullivan and Mick O'Dwyer, when they went to Gormanston for a coaching course in the 70s, I think in 74, they saw the Dublin team and the intensity of which they were training. And they came across this and came back to Kerry in 1975 and said, we're not going to do the old training methods, the old fitness standards aren't going to work anymore. So they produced, undoubtedly, there isn't an argument about this, the greatest football team this island has ever seen out of that, because innovation is what Kerry does. Reaction is what Kerry does. There was an assumption almost within Dr. Eamon O'Sullivan's time that a Kerry footballer is going to be more skillful than his opponent. That you will, if you put a cornerback and a corner forward from any one of the other 31 counties together, and it's a Kerry cornerback, they can play this sort of game, this zone game, because the natural skill of a Kerry footballer is going to be higher. This is what, this is what I came across when I was 11, and what is true today, that Gaelic football subsumes every aspect it's learned from the cradle. So when somebody beats them, and somebody comes up with a new scheme or a new tactic, Kerry reacts, and Kerry reacts usually with success. That's where all the All-Irelands came from.
Oh, and you've raised some fascinating points there. And of course, we're talking about tradition. We're talking about the handing down and the evolution of football and Kerry evolving with it. You did mention that Dick Fitzgerald mentioned about skill in Gaelic games. And are you saying, or was he saying, or is it true that Gaelic football is more skillful than any other game that we watch? Is that what we're saying?
Absolutely. I mean, Fitzgerald believed further that Gaelic football, if it was the type of football which came most naturally to a human being as opposed to all the other codes. He said that Gaelic football is what might be called a natural football game. There is no incentive in it towards rough play. One player may hamper or impede another in one way, and there is only one way, and that is by means of the shoulder. Hence it is that severe tackling, rough handling and all forms of tripping are banned. In other words, Gaelic football is the purest form of football, and there should never be any instances of fouling in a Gaelic football match. Of course, unfortunately for the referees of the country, that bit didn't turn out to be true.
And Owen, could we read into today's world now, where the yellow cards and red cards are in and the G are stamping down and the type of stuff that Dick Fitzgerald really came down on? Are the G today so? Are they trying to make the game in Gaelic football the way Dick Fitzgerald wanted it?
Gaelic football always had a problem with the tackle. And Dick's and a lot of the great Kerry people who thought through the game, because, you know, the football isn't from the ball being thrown in to the final whistle. An awful lot of what is the important parts of football culture is what goes on before and afterwards. The talking about the game, the lore, folklore of the game, the ballads, the songs, and the thinking about the game. And Kerry men were, you know, right through to what we see today with so many Kerry managers, not just the Mick O'Dwyer's and the Paddy O'Shea's, but counties throughout Munster have used Kerry men as their managers for one reason. They understand the game better. They think about the game better. Dick Fitzgerald thought about the game in his time, and his philosophy on the tackle was it was a clean shoulder. That's the only way, the only reason, the only thing you needed to do to dispossess an opponent. And in a world where people are releasing the ball every 5 yards and soloing properly and all of that, that's all that was necessary. It never really was as pure as that. And even within Kerry, I mean, there are people the length and breadth of the county who will recall some of the characters who would have been involved in famous matches like the 46 semi-final against Antrim, where Kerry brought a halt to very fast hand-passing play. But in Dick Fitzgerald's world, the referee would only need be blowing his whistle 3 or 4 times in a match. Unfortunately, that ideal world probably never came to pass.
And against that then, Kerry keep throwing up down through the decades footballers of pure class and genius. You had the likes of the Landers back in the 30s and the 40s, and then in the 50s you had the likes of Tiggy Lyon and Johnny Cullity playing corner forward. Then in the 60s up along you had the Sheehys, and then you had the likes of Mickey Sheehy, and then coming up along you had Seamus Minan and Maurice Fitzgerald, and then you had the likes of Colm Cooper and Kieran Donnie, all pure footballers.
And you said it there, pure footballers. It's, is it breeding? Is it nature? Is it nurture?
Decade after decade.
I mean, the argument comes up in hurling all the time, and people infinitely talk about Kilkenny and Tipperary and Cork, and are hurlers born, not made? But in Kerry's instance, the made footballers are there from every parish. I mean, you might remember, Weeshie, the ridiculous habit we had in 1999 of picking teams of the millennium, as if Gaelic football was played for 2,000 years, and we could all recall who played in the 1525 when it was banned in Galway or whatever. But an awful lot of those teams featured really players from the same era, because they were players who were playing when the panels picking the teams of the century or the teams of the millennium were young. So when you see someone in your teens, your 20s, you think he's a better footballer. What's interesting in the Kerry case is they could have filled a team of the millennium just from County Kerry. In fact, you could have got one from North Kerry and from South Kerry, perhaps. And you would have put a strong case for every one of those players in those 15 positions. for being the greatest footballer ever in that position. And it happened that Kerry ended up with quite a few of the team of the millennium. I got, I remember doing a GA book of lists a few years ago, and I got some great writers to pick their all-time football team. And I think Con Houlihan put 15 Kerry men on the greatest team of all time. And he put a Kerry hurler in as well in the hurling team, just for good.
While you could never own, pick out who was the greatest of all in Kerry, like, but still, and Mick O'Connell is held up as one of the purest, one of the most skillful, one of the most, I suppose, graceful and elegant of all footballers. And we can just pick one name, but I suppose he would typify what we are talking about in the line of everything that's good and great in Gaelic football.
Absolutely. Mick O'Connell, and there was an eccentricity, and there was a lore about Mick O'Connell. His place in folklore was as important. The thing about leaving the cup in the dressing room, all of that was just as important. But I notice another, if you go back through loads of newspaper files, I spent an awful lot of my life going through old newspaper GA reports because I love it. I just adore all of the language that was used and the assessments that were used, the way people wrote about it. But you will actually find Sean Murphy, you know, in his one year, being hailed as one of the greatest players of all time. You will find Mick O'Connell's arrival around 1964, 1965. You know, he dwarfed everybody else. And a couple of instances of tremendous catches, you know, which would get the crowd, they'd light up the crowd. And in some ways, the great Paddy Kennedy, Mick O'Connell, Jack O'Shea. I mean, you've even filling midfield for the greatest team of all time. You've got a lot of candidates from Kerry, and that's not going back to that's not counting the people who existed before the memory of the writers of today, like Pat O'Shea from Castle Gregory, the Airplane O'Shea. There isn't any newsreel footage. We don't know what he played like. All we know is that the likes of Paddy Foley, who were writing in the 40s, said he was one of the greatest they'd ever seen. And then each generation brings on a couple of candidates for the greatest footballer of all time. The Kerry team that won the All-Irelands of 07 and 08 would have a set of forwards that I think if you went back through the history of Gaelic football, you'd work very, very hard to find a set of forwards like the Kerry teams of the last 10 years. So if you go position by position, you'll find each year there's one player that tends to dominate. You know, was there a performance in the entire history of Gaelic football, like the last 20 minutes we saw from Pat Spillane in 86 against Tyrone? Was there... with each year, there is a player who was put in a tremendous, outstanding performance, added a moment into the canon of GA history. Maurice Fitzgerald's sideline ball against Dublin.
Seamus Moynihan.
You can actually, out of every year, pick out two or three personalities whose performances, who have produced a performance that creates a folklore of its own and gets people talking, all of that. That's all you can really achieve. You can't actually sit down and say he's the better footballer, this 20 minutes of a player's life is better than 40 minutes of another player's life. But what Kerry players consistently have done is, if you pick out of the entire country two or three players that have connected with the audience, that have actually got people talking, got people singing, making ballads about them, they tend to be the two or three, one half of them, maybe two thirds of them have been Kerry men. And other counties measured their progress against Kerry. Other counties saw Roscommon being a good example, beating Cavan in the All-Ireland final. It wasn't a real All-Ireland when you talk to those Roscommon boys until they'd actually beaten Kerry in an All-Ireland final. It was so important for Down. They beat Offaly in the All-Ireland final. Beating Kerry in the All-Ireland final is a big deal. It's still important, obviously, in Tyrone, and we won't go there.
Not for a while. Getting back again to the early part of the decades and the Civil War in Kerry, because it definitely united football, and the men that had fought against each other came out and they played together, and they stood shoulder to shoulder on the field.
For two reasons here, because this wasn't happening everywhere. Everybody says the GA was a great unifying factor after the Civil War. And it was. It was the one forum where the two sides got around a table and talked. It was the one forum where the players actually played on the same field. Now, up and down the country, there were different reactions to the Civil War within the GAA. I remember Martin Walsh, the 1932 All-Ireland medalist for Kilkenny, saying that really, if, and Kilkenny would have been a very strong anti-treaty county, South Kilkenny, really anti-treaty players didn't get picked on the Kilkenny team of the 20s. Clare ended up with two county boards, you know, with 27 clubs in one, 26 in the other, almost exact symmetry between the pair of them. They had two county boards and two county championships during the Civil War. We had situations where players were arrested, matches were stopped, and the Free State soldiers came in and arrested. We had a great situation in Kildare where the county champions lost the title. The county senior football champions had the title taken off them because one of the players had played under an assumed name. Why had he played under an assumed name? He was on the run. He was an anti-treaty player. In Kerry, you had the very famous amnesty given to John Joe Sheehy and Con Brosnan, of course, stood for Fine Gael, or what was later Fine Gael in 1932. He was as Free State.
How significant was what we are going to discuss here now on about these two men?
I'll tell you what was significant was everybody could look to Kerry and say, if Kerry can do it. And Kerry got the reward for it. It's not just that Kerry did it. Kerry got the reward for it. You know, a county that did it and wasn't stacking up the All-Irelands as Kerry were in the 1920s as a result of it. Everybody who was bickering and fighting and still calling each other names could look down and say, if Kerry can do it. Because there's another thing, and the second thing here is, there is nothing as bitter as what happened in Kerry during the Civil War. There is nothing as bad as Ballyseedy and Countess Bridge. These are these are war atrocities, you know, in the international scale of things that would cause outrage anywhere. And these were the people who got back together. The story is well told. I'll retell it for anyone who doesn't know, which I doubt if there is that when the internees were released, they played two selection matches, friendly matches. I can imagine how friendly they were. The Civil War people, the anti-treaty side against the pro-treaty side. In Tralee, that was the selection match for the All-Ireland final. The United team then got played in the All-Ireland final. They didn't just, they went on to dominate football in the 1920s completely and won the for Kerry's first in a row, 29-32. Now, what Kerry, and even during the war, John Joe Sheehy was allowed play. He did in a Munster final, I think it was against Clare, and he went to the match, emerged from the crowd with his togs on under his coat, threw the coat on the sideline, played the match alongside Con Brosnan. He's on the run. Con Brosnan's one of the men who's supposed to be hunting for John Joe Sheehy, and he goes back, throws the coat on, doesn't go back into the dressing room. Too big an ask, you know, because there was players were being arrested in other counties. But he did that and he had the courage to do that. And Con Brosnan and the boys had the courage to do it on the other side. So if everybody else could look and say, this is the county of Ballyseedy and they're able to get back together, they're able to play together and they're winning stacks of All-Irelands because... when you count the greatest football matches of all time, we've already mentioned 1913, the Kerry Louth match, 1926 Kerry Kildare would have been counted as another one. Larry Stanley, the great Kildare midfielder, able to catch the ball with one hand. That this is the reward for what was happening within the Kildare team would have had some anti-treaty and pro-treaty players. Bertie Graham would have been anti-treaty. Five of the players, like people like Paul Doyle, Frank Malone, all of these were pro-treaty players. So you ended up in a situation where other counties were able to get over their differences because they saw Kerry getting over their differences and winning. And there's nothing like the prospect of an All-Ireland for getting people to get over their little differences.
And of course, moving up along then up to the 40s and the 50s, who were the great names and the great personalities that you know about that influenced the GAA and influenced Kerry football from, we'd say, the 40s and the 50s, moving up a little bit on, before we come to Sean Kelly, of course?
Well, the Kerry came out of a pretty grim period in the 30s, but when you see the emergence of the 40s players, a lot of it happened around 1937, 1938. We had this extraordinary situation in 1938 where the final whistle was called, a free was whistled for, and some of the players left the field, and some of the guys who were in their civvies came on, you know, were called on to make up the 15 players.
It was the final.
The All-Ireland final between Kerry and Galway. Kerry couldn't have finished the match. There were 2 minutes still to play. Some of the players had gone. I think Paddy Bawn Brosnan was one, a great character, you know. Paddy Bawn, when he was asked in the 70s, you know, about all these solicitors and teachers and, you know, these white-collar men that were playing for Kerry, how many solicitors had you playing for Kerry in your time? And he said, we'd a few farmers, a few fishermen and a college boy to take the frees. But Paddy Bawn would have, that was his debut. It wasn't a great debut. He actually played very well in the 40s afterwards, and his reputation was built in the 40s afterwards. But Joe Keohane, who was injured, came back to play in that match. So a lot of the that 1938 team emerged to become the great team of the 40s. The two goals Roscommon were leading Kerry by 6 points in the late minute, with about 3 minutes to go in the 46 All Ireland. Kerry drew the match with two goals and won the replay. There was when you talked to people, even 40 years after the match, some people picked that out as one of the most amazing occasions they'd ever seen. And Paddy Kennedy would be the leading character out of that. Dan O'Keefe, 8 All-Ireland medals, the famous horseshoe in the back of the net that he used to bring for good luck. Mm. And in 1953, he gave it to his successor, Johnny Foley.
A man I spend an afternoon with this evening. He's recovering from a stroke, the man in his will. Talking about, it's amazing talking about 46, and you're talking about it there, that even today there's a lot of talk about the Kerry captaincy, who should be, who shouldn't be, who's going to be. But strange enough, in 46, there was 3 Kerry captains. There was Eddie Dowling was captain for one game, and he was dropped. And then Gus Crimmin was dropped, and he took it very badly. And then Paddy Kennedy became captain. So the captaincy and Kerry is an ongoing thing. It was going back there to the 30s and the 40s.
Yeah, and
the way they picked their captain in Kerry. What do you think of that, Owen, in relation to the county champions nominate the captain?
It's purely back to those early days of the GA. That's exactly what I was saying. Kerry changed the system where the club got to play. The GA never had decided to have an inter-county championship. They had something like 435 clubs in 1887. So they said, let's play it off at county level first. So then we'll have the Kerry champions play the Cork champions, and that'll make the administration easier. It didn't work out like that because Kerry decided in Kilmoyle's case that and Ballyduff that Kilmoyle should disband and the best players should play with Ballyduff to play in the All-Ireland hurling final. And then all the Cork clubs started disbanding. So what Kerry have is the residue of that old system where the club used to represent the county. Instead of the club actually representing the county, the club got the captaincy. Now, really interesting, Weeshie, is that this was prevalent through the rest of the country, except it was really in the 70s and 80s that counties started dismantling that system. And I know one manager who nominated his captain, and the captain was nominated by the manager and he was chosen, and it didn't matter whether he was the county champion club or not. And he said, that's okay for Kerry, because Kerry have so many fine footballers, they'll find 15 players who will actually will be willing or able to captain the team. But in fact, it's another example of the egalitarianism of the GAA. The GAA isn't a hierarchical organisation with people with managers and owners and chairmen and people who decide from the top goes down. What happened? It's a democratic system. If the club wins the championship, and Kerry's a bit more complicated because of the area teams as well, but if the club wins the championship, they're entitled to the captaincy. It's not the it doesn't say care what the county board says. It doesn't care what the manager says. That's what it gets. And that's how you get 18-year-old, 19-year-old captains. I don't know what age Ambrose O'Donovan was, but you get very young captains.
Do you think that, why have Kerry held on to this? And how significant is it that they held on to this system?
It's significant. It's not significant in Kerry because the order and the discipline of the teams down the years is so terrific. In other counties, really, factionalism would creep in at the wrong time. And you would end up with immense rows over who should be the captain. So Kerry was above this. There's a sense that Kerry is above this. It's a ritual thing. It's a bit like the pre-match parade. It's a bit like the It's More an Honour Dom and Cornshaw at Locker. It's part of the ritual. It doesn't really matter that much because the captain is not seen as it's seen as an honorary position. It's not seen as something that is important. It doesn't give someone that immense status.
It's not always the best man.
It's not always, and very rare. Sometimes it's not the best man. And the other thing is that the motivational skills that are acquired from a captain, usually it's given to an old player who, has been around for donkey's years. And in the counties where the captaincy is the captain is nominated by the selectors. In Kerry, that's not the case. But what we found is tremendous motivational skills among fellows who are 19 and 20 years of age, talking to Ambrose O'Donovan being a good example before the Munster final. Gunny Goyla, he says, I have to live with these Cork fellows for 12 months. That's all he needed to say. Yeah. And all of those guys, some of them had 6 or 7 All-Ireland medals in the same room as him. That's all he needed. The motivational skills are there. It's not tremendously significant, but it has led to some terrific rows over who should get the captaincy of Kerry team down through the years.
Another point I want to raise with you, and you touched on it there a while ago, and you only have it as unique to Kerry and Cork, are divisional teams. Now, I believe myself that they have been one of the bases of Kerry's successes down through the years. I played with a divisional team for 13 years myself, with East Kerry, and there was 13 clubs involved in that team. They mightn't be as big now, but still, divisional teams, South Kerry have been winning county championships, Field Rangers won one lately. And it's only in Cork and Kerry that you have these divisional teams.
Okay, what happens if you don't have divisional teams? You end up in the Junior B team, you play great. You win the Junior B championship. Everyone thinks you're great, and you're the star of the town and the hero of the town. You're also playing football, where you get an hour and a half to gather the ball. Make a big wide turn and give it a good kick. In a junior club, in a small junior club, if you're playing well and you're selected on a divisional team, you're immediately thrown into a faster pace of football, a higher standard of football. Yeah. You're coming up against fellas who are star really, players, really star players. They've won All-Irelands. They're skillful. And you're not put up on a pedestal. Yeah. You're not going on drinking on a Tuesday night and fellas buying you pints because you're now given this chance all the time. There's another step to get up to. You get from your Junior B club up to the divisional team. You're now in the running for the county. You get up onto the county team. Yeah. You're now there dealing
like Darren O'Sullivan from Mid-Kerry this year, who Mid-Kerry won the county championship and now he's captain of Kerry.
Absolutely amazing. And this is, players get old, they get a bit bitter, they become, they have to work their way Junior B, Junior A, Intermediate, all of that stuff. They get kicked. There's always a fellow who's, with a big beer belly, whose only job is to sort out the star player on the other team. Some of that will still go on. But the reality is that you're getting the rewards immediately delivered to you. At 18 and 19 years of age, you're immediately delivered. You're given there's pressures on you as well. You have to deliver the standard of football at a divisional level that you wouldn't be, that at a higher level, to which you wouldn't get away with at Junior B. And it puts players under pressure. It also, there's another thing about Kerry is that the way football is played is probably You know, this is something that really only became relevant in the aftermath of what Dublin and Meath were doing to each other in the 80s and 90s in Leinster, and what the Ulster teams did. Probably, you know, you had that incredible Meath Tyrone stuff in 96, and what Tyrone did to Kerry, you know, closing off the players hunting and pass.
The swarming
football. Elbow grease, you know, your elbows around you, players around you, everywhere you go. Young players in Kerry seem, and maybe that this theory won't hold up, but I do have an instinct that young players in Kerry from an early age seem to have more room to move in. It does make, it does give the young, it does give a forward a little bit of time, not even time, speed is of the essence, but it gives them the incentive to be creative, to use their skills, to be glick all the time, to be fast thinking all the time, to do that, what Mikey Sheehy did to Paddy Cullen all the time. And that seems to be instilled at an early age. They seem to be given room to move, there's less cynicism and there's less closing down of players. Now maybe that's changing, but there's certainly the assembly line. It's like the Volkswagen plant of players, of fine Kerry footballers that have been coming off this assembly line over the last 20, 30 years, and they all, each one beating the other in terms of that skill and that quickness of mind and that pace. Now, you don't get pace. You don't build up pace. Players aren't rewarded for pace in a closed down, grim environment where you're being crowded all the time and players are swarming around you all the time. Kerry seems to have got that right, and they've got the rewards for it. That's the key all the time. I keep saying that. If you're winning the All-Irelands with that sort of football, it's an incentive to everyone to continue doing it like that. And the players, the young players coming through, see this is the way to go.
The division, staying with the division aspect of Kerry football, Owen, and I think it's fascinating because you've touched great points, and I believe myself how important it is. Looking you from outside, looking in at Kerry now, how important is the divisional teams in Kerry? How do they have given great players? Would they not be the force they are today without divisional teams? I put that to you.
It's hard to say they would or they wouldn't. I suspect whatever you did with Kerry, if you banned football, you know, for 11 months of the year and only allowed to be played, well, Kerry would still be a force. The football is so ingrained in the culture. Now, what are you looking for from your system? You're looking for the community involvement to be increased. You're looking for more participants. You're looking for more people to be playing the games. But you're also looking for rewards at an elite level. Divisional teams are probably better for serving the elite. These fine footballers, the county men. You know, it gives a young player the chance to play at a high level. It keeps them under pressure. It keeps them, you know, if you're playing well in a Junior B match, you're suddenly in a divisional team where the pace is faster, where the skill levels are higher. So it's a great incentive to bring players forward. But the strength of the GA through the 32 counties, remember we've 2,600 clubs out there, and there are 2,600 different GAAs out there. It's not just the 83,000 that go to the 30 players who play and the 83,000 who watch them All-Ireland final day. This is going on 12 months of the year. That's why the GA is a great organisation. And divisional teams sometimes means that you don't have the club structure as strong as it might be. I know other counties that have tried divisional teams have dropped the idea after a while because it does raise the hackles of the club.
And Kerry's displays in All-Ireland club senior championship over the last couple of decades has been very poor. That bears out what you're saying.
Yeah, you see, within Kerry you have these amazingly strong clubs, Austin Stacks, Crokes, Castle Island Desmonds, Killorgle and Lorne Rangers. Now, when a club gets strong enough to play divisional teams on its own, that's the cream, but they're effectively getting the cake and eating it. But divisional teams are great for bringing footballers forward, not for bringing clubs forward. Yeah. So when you know, what are you looking for from the system? If you're looking for more All-Irelands, I think divisional teams are the way forward. If you're looking for that strong club structure and the very high levels of participation that we have in the GAA, because it's a huge membership. I mean, governments in other European countries are trying to get kids out from the couch or from the sofa watching watching satellite television matches to getting them out to participate. And the GAA has been doing that for decades for free. Now, I don't think the criticism that I just voiced really applies to Kerry, because the Kerry club structure is so strong anyway. You know, the clubs, the Waterfields of the world can survive and be very strong in an environment and still represent South Kerry. And part of that is the geography of the county, Weishi. Part of it is the notion that you can drive for 100 miles and still be in Kerry. The club, the divisional teams help, the divisional team structure helps get over the mountains, literally, helps get over that organisational problem of having clubs dispersed through the county and with huge huge distances on mountainy roads between them.
And you had an amazing example of what you're talking about there only lately, when two small clubs from South Kerry, St Michael's Filemore and Skellig Rangers, two parish teams, went up to Croke Park, played under lights and won two All-Irelands playing wonderful football, open football, two small little clubs from down in the tail end of South Kerry. And you're talking about the mountains and the sea and everything, they're bordered by boat.
It's unbelievable. And
so this is all, again, what we're talking about, the tradition and the history of Kerry.
What is interesting is that Kerry were very strong proponents of the club championship. The GAA did not want to know the club championship. They wanted the Railway Cup St Patrick's Day. They wanted a clean fixtures board. They wanted a couple of grounds tournaments, whatever. They didn't want this clogging up the Sundays. Now, the senior club, they allowed divisional teams in the very first club championships, and East Kerry obviously did well out of that. But in recent years, the senior club championship has become a huge success with 40,000 crowds, huge crowds on Patrick's Day. But again, effectively against the GAA's, you know, the hierarchy did not want the intermediate and junior inter-county club championships. They didn't want an All-Ireland intermediate championship. What it's done for the game has been fascinating. And Weishi, there's no coverage. You could read the national newspapers and watch RTE till the cows come home, but you won't see any evidence of an All-Ireland semi-final at intermediate or junior club level, except your good, this being Radio Kerry, the magnificent coverage you've been giving. But what it's done for, not just for Kerry, you just talked about the Kerry clubs, what it's doing in Leitrim, what it's doing in Wicklow, yeah. What's it doing in Carlow, what's it doing in Longford, up and down the length and breadth of the country, junior clubs and intermediate clubs have a new lease of life. And it's another huge triumph of the GAA. And like many other previous triumphs of the GAA, it's achieved against the abject opposition of the GAA hierarchy in Croke Park.
And this brings me right on to what I'm going to discuss with you next. Sean Kelly. Sean Kelly was the man that introduced the intermediate and the junior championship. He being a Kerry man. He was the man who opened up Croke Park against all the odds. And on his latest last week, I put the question to him. What was the most important thing he did, opening Croke Park or introducing the junior and intermediate championship? Without any hesitation, introducing the intermediate and junior championship. So, Sean Kelly.
Sean Kelly, opening Croke Park is a footnote. I mean, people will look back in 100 years' time and they'll look at the letters pages of the Irish Times and they say, what was this about? Opening up Croke Park, you can see loads of reasons for not opening up Croke Park. The GAA had built the stadium against serious opposition, people telling them they were mad to do it. There was a council member of the FAI who said that it was great for the FAI because it would bankrupt the GAA. You know, they were the ones with the courage to do it. And they were a bit cranky about the notion of people who really hadn't done an awful lot to further their own cause, now demanding admittance. Sean Kelly's stance was perfectly right. You know, you're not just, it's a national issue. You're not a small body in a big island. The people who go to the All-Ireland final are very often the same people who go to watch a rugby match or a soccer match. So they're the ones who are being penalised. So why penalise them? You know, why get factional about this? But the debate, it had to be gone, and the GAA being a very democratic organisation, it had to be voted on at Congress, which meant every club and official and all of these people got involved. And it probably wasn't good for PR, because it gave critics of the GAA, and the GAA is very, very jumpy about criticism, it gave critics of the GAA free run, saying why won't they let soccer and rugby in. Sean Kelly's achievement, I don't know how he did it actually, because if anyone would have asked me 10 years ago, would a GAA official be able to steer the very strong personalities, some of them in Cork, some of them in the north, through this? I'd have said it'd be very difficult for them to. I wouldn't fancy their chance. It's an unpopular thing, and it's also a necessary thing to do. But he got it through. It'll be a footnote in history. The junior and the intermediate championships will grow and grow and grow, and people will forever have a little village in Kerry this year or Leitrim next year or Fermanagh the next, will have something to celebrate. And that it's a terrific legacy to have given the GAA. And again, you know, all sorts of opposition. I wouldn't have fancied his chances of getting that idea through everything, through all the motions as well. But it's another example. It's another Kerry innovation. We haven't even started touching on it, and we've already been talking for a long time, all the different contributions that Kerry made to the GAA. Interesting, Sean Kelly was their first president. Lots and lots of Cork men have been presidents, a couple of Dubliners, even a couple of Wicklow people have been president. Kerry tended to do their talking on the football field. It's in terms of what has been achieved, though, and in the initiatives, you know, when the National League was proposed by a Cork man in the 20s, it was really that Kerry got behind it. Kerry took it seriously, and the great Kerry team of the late 20s won in the 27 and 28. The first one, I think, went to Leash, the 27 and 28 ones. And then, you know, people have forgotten that there was football in Kerry between 1970 and 1975. But Kerry dominated the league at that stage and kept the competition alive. And, you know, every single success, where GAA initiatives have been probably started by other counties, it has been when Kerry got behind them that their success or failure was determined. If Kerry ignored something, which it occasionally did, or lost interest in it, which it did, with the Railway Cup being a very good example, the whole thing just came off the rails.
Just one or two more points on before we finish, because it has been fascinating talking to you. In relation to Kerry and Kerry men down through the years, and you have read and you have studied and you have written and all, what Kerry people, name off 20 names of 15 or 20 names of Kerry people that come to your mind that have played a huge part in the GAA in this county. You can name them all, of course, but rattle off a number of names, both players and officials.
Okay, it depends again what you're looking for. I mean, if you were to pick the most influential footballers of all time, I would say that it's very likely you'd have put J.P. O'Sullivan in there. It's very likely that's Dr. Eamon's father. You'd have put in Dick Fitzgerald. You'd put in Pat Airplane O'Shea, probably from 1913-14 team. These are before my time. You look at Paul Russell, what he achieved. You look at what John Joe Sheehy achieved. When you go up to the 30s, you got the Landers and the Lions. I mean, the 37 football final was supposed to be a terrific and dominated by J.J. Landers, I think. The 40s teams, Paddy Kennedy, one of the most influential footballers of all time, Bat Garvey, people like that. Into the 50s, and Dan O'Keefe would have to be in there. Then you're into the 60s. Mick O'Dwyer would be a house. Mick O'Connor would be a household name, and Mick O'Dwyer, as a player, would be one of the most influential players of his time. Into the 70s, you're into the 15, you're into almost everybody that played in that 75 team. And Mick Spillane, if you remember, took part in one of the RT very first efforts at celebrity television, and to this notion that you'd have two household names in the same household, Pat Spillane and Mick Spillane, is just a
who was your favourite Kerry footballer?
My favourite Kerry footballer, probably Pat Spillane, and I would pick him out as being, inspiration. I think, though, that some of the unheralded, the guys who did, the John O'Keefes of the world, the Dennis Ogie Moran, they're players that weren't expansive in their football, but did probably far more than some of the players who is. What tends to influence everybody's memory, Weishi, is that you remember a particular incident, or you remember a particular spell of play of 10 or 20 minutes. You forget the rest. You forget the rest of the match. You have players whose performances over 70 minutes wouldn't be as strong as somebody who can come into the match for 2 minutes or 3 minutes and win the match. It's a factor in all sport. I mean, Seamus Darby wasn't on the starting team for 82 that derailed Kerry's five in a row. But if you look at what that 70s team did, and you factor in, you're looking across decades, and these are all, there is no newsreel from before the 30s and 40s. You can't really evaluate for, but if you're to take one match that shows how superior that Kerry team were to everything else that was going on, and we can get hung up on the, there's an awful lot of folklore and nonsense really being spoken about the whole Kerry-Dublin rivalry and that 77 match. When you look at the video, it really wasn't as good as they make out. But if you to pick one match that shows how the great Kerry team are, how superior they were to everyone else. It was a muddy day in Tralee, and I think it was around November of 1978, and they beat Laois by 6 goals and 11 points to 0 in a National League match. There is no instance, probably, in the history of the National League where one football team came off the field without scoring and the other one had run up a huge score. Like Kerry have scored more in matches against Kerry. That shows those 15 footballers are that panel of 25, and there were great players who played around the same time, who played at the same time, who never made the All Ireland teams of Kerry at the time, and it just shows the superiority of the football that they played.
And now, there's something happening at the moment, something different from any other generation, because you have the sons of these lads from the 70s. You have Ogie Moran's two sons playing with Kerry. You have Sean Welch's son playing. You have the late Tim Kennelly's son playing. And you have Jack O'Shea's son playing. Yeah. So this is something that we have never experienced before, that in the one team you have five or six sons of all these great men playing. So again, the whole thing is evolving in Kerry. Something different is happening here, isn't it?
Well, there are dynasties all the time. I mean, the Sheehys, John Joe's sons, were around. They came on and won All Ireland in their own way, and I think the Lions were uncles of the Spillanes, the three Spillanes, the three Lions. It's a dynastic thing. But what's interesting about Kerry is some other counties have the dynasty where, just because you're somebody's son, you tend to get fast tracked to the county team. I have a fair feeling that doesn't happen in Kerry. There's so much of a fight for the county, for the places, and there's such a high standard through the county that making the team isn't something that you get by right and by being the son. I mean, there have been allegations and rows about this down the years, but I suspect that we'll see the grandchildren when the time comes as well, and that is the beauty of Kerry football.
Because Mick O'Dwyer, cutting across from Mick O'Dwyer, reckons that his son Carol didn't get a fair break in Kerry, so he said to himself, I'll give you a fair break. He brought him up to Kildare, won the Leinster Championship medal and won an All-Star. So that bears up what you're saying.
there is an element, you know, that just because you're somebody's son, in fact, it can weigh against you. And the politics of Kerry, I mean, are the politics of Kerry football are not for the weak-hearted either. So, I mean, Kerry's history is full of, selection rows. There's no other way of putting it. There was strikes where the entire Gaeltacht club, I think, pulled out in one case because one player had been dropped. But the dynasty isn't as significant as the fact that the sons of the great players have to fight for their places. Nobody's got their automatic place. And the selection of the manager is such, I mean, on this very programme, you've had very many managers talking about how no matter what you do in Kerry, you get no credit for it. And the Kerry supporters are quite vociferous in their criticism. That's part of the beauty of it. They're used to success. You know, they're used to success and they demand the very, very high standards. And maybe that's the right approach. Maybe that's what high achievement is all about in life, in business, in every aspect of life. It always struck me as really odd that Kerry didn't supply very many ministers. I mean, Dick Spring and Austin Stack in his time and people like that would have been, but cabinet ministers. But if you ever looked at the civil service, the people who were actually running the country while the politicians were off having dinner, at least half the departments were headed up by Kerry men. And I often wondered, is the success in football that Kerry and the success in public life that Kerry has achieved, are they related to each other? They don't. There's no stopping at the middleman, the politician. That's just going straight to the top gun. And
Final pint, Fiona. If you look back through all the All-Ireland winning Kerry teams, back through the decades, the men in the sideline, you had five, maybe six selectors at times, but they all possessed maybe two or three All-Ireland medals each. I have noticed that even today, that if you were to pick a Kerry team of managers or trainers, whatever you would want, you could pick all All-Ireland winners. So the fact that Kerry have these men on the line and they have the know-how, how important is that? And us Kerry, and we say Kilkenny in the hurling and Cork in the hurling, very lucky. How important is it to have highly experienced All-Ireland medal winners on the line, guiding, directing, changing, managing, and training your team?
What it gives you is status. That's something that probably it took me a while to realise, and something I came across was the amount of status, the prestige that goes with the All-Ireland medal. It actually, some of the best Kerry officials and Kerry selectors didn't have an All-Ireland medal. The great manager, great player, maybe half and half. It doesn't, in every sport, it doesn't actually automatically follow. But what it does, it gives you that authority. When you're sitting around a table debating over selecting a team or getting involved in arguments, if you've had a couple of All-Irelands in the back pocket, I mean, Dermot O'Brien used to tell the great story about boasting to a Kerry man how he had an All-Ireland medal, and the Kerry man said, I have four or five of those in the drawer myself, you know. But it gives you that authority, and that's where it's important. Is it important in the long run? Not really. I mean, I would say that some of the great strategists in the game and some of the great managers in the game, including the man who took the five in a row off Kerry, Eugene McGee, really had no playing career, no playing experience. And sometimes an injured footballer or a player who spends their 20s thinking about the game and involved in strategy and management can do better than somebody with an awful lot of All-Ireland.
Of course, the present man, Jack O'Connor, has proven that. He's an outstanding trainer, and Pat Shea before him. Finally, Owen, sum up Kerry for us. You come in outside, can you sense it in the air? Can you, when you meet people and you're talking about people, what's Kerry to you?
Kerry's a state of mind. It's not really a landscape at all. And the sense of achievement I just talked about is partly due to the fact that it's sort of the southwest of the country, but it's on the Atlantic, and it's not pinned up against anywhere. It's a wide, broad, open mind. The Atlantic is a highway. America's out there. It's close to these guys. When they played the Polo Grounds in 1947, it was the next parish. When it's also, there's a sense that the world is out there to be conquered, and that's what Kerry people did, and that's what Kerry people have done. And it's if you were to look around the different counties of Ireland, and if you make the landscape, you know, match the landscape with the character or with the mindset of the people, I think there's no more appropriate metaphor than the fact that Kerry have the highest mountain in Ireland. That's why they want to be top all the time. Carn Tuil and Mount Brandon, which the Gaeltacht boys would, of course, throw in as well. The sense of achievement, the reason that they lead the All-Ireland football charts is something to do with that landscape, with that openness, and with the sense that no matter where you look, there's something always beyond it.
Owen, listen to me, it was fascinating talking to you. We had a long talk and long interview, and thanks for talking to Terrace Talk.
Thank you, Wishy.